We were in the most enviable position that a nation could be in.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by The Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, Bulwark contributor. My partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, is still traveling, but I'm privileged to be joined today by a very special guest, the Bulwark's own Mona Charon. Mona, welcome back to Shield of the Republic.
It's always an honor, Eric. Thanks for inviting me.
I'm just thrilled to have you. And we've got so much to talk about. Before we launch into a very rich menu of events this week, I want to get something off my chest. A lot of comments on Shield of the Republic have, over the last several weeks, have made the point that we are analyzing what President Trump is saying as if he's a normal president, and he's unhinged, and he's demented, and he's suffering from some form of, pretemporal dementia. I would just like to, as lawyers would say, I'm not a lawyer and I don't play one on TV or on this podcast, but I want to stipulate for any and all that much of what the president says is unhinged. His behavior is such that he may very well be suffering from some form of dementia or early stages of it. But I don't think that absolves the rest of us from the obligation of analyzing what it is he's saying and what its potential implications could be in the real world. So, end of sermon.
Agreed. And if I may just add, there's a lot of evidence that the man is not in his right mind. I agree. Although, there are countervailing arguments that it's not that he's insane. It's just that he has the worst judgment of any person in the last century. Okay. But the thing is, the fact that he is demented and that there has not been an uprising of other people in authority in the United States to rein him in, to either invoke the 25th Amendment, to impeach, to do something to rein him in, shows that there are deep structural problems with our whole system. And it implicates not just Trump, but unfortunately our system, which seems unable to cope with having an insane leader.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, as JVL has pointed out repeatedly, the remedy in our system for a president who had the kind of demagogic instincts that Trump has, and the founders clearly had it in mind, was impeachment. Unfortunately, we've proven repeatedly now that impeachment is a dead letter in our republic, and so we're stuck with him. Until either nature takes its course or he leaves office, he's what we have. So he had a meeting yesterday with Mark Rutte, the Secretary General of NATO. It was atypically not one in which cameras were invited into the Oval. It went on for quite a while, 2.5 hours. Clearly, it was described as a very frank, very tough meeting between the NATO Secretary General and the President. And it was previewed by the press secretary as one in which he might notify the Secretary General that the United States was going to leave NATO. Now, that apparently did not happen, although there are still reports in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere that the President is considering punishing some NATO member nations. What do you make of all that?
It's important to remember that Mark Rutte has been considered the Trump whisperer in Europe, that he's really bent over backwards to ingratiate himself with Trump. He even at one point called him daddy. He insists that was a little taken out of context, and perhaps it was, but he has been incredibly servile and ingratiating. Now, on the one hand, when he was doing that on behalf of trying to keep Trump in the tent to stay firm on Ukraine, it seemed like a good plan. But it is, I think, a reflection of the fact that, Europe is desperate. They recognize that this is a whole new world and that Trump is destroying NATO, and they are, or is, let's put it this way. He is severely hampering NATO. And so, but when you consider that the U.S. contributes such a disproportionate share of military might to NATO, contemplating a post-U.S. NATO is really a grim thing. And so Rutte, I think, feels that it's his obligation to do whatever he can, even if it comes to a certain amount of self-abasement, to keep Trump on side. And now Trump has lately pushed things even further, you know, damaging our European allies with this ill-begotten war in Iran and then berating them for not joining it. And so maybe that's why this meeting, unlike previous ones, was not public, because Rutte this time was not going to engage in the kind of slavish praise that he's done in the past. But it's a very, very tough spot for NATO.
The worst, of course, does not appear to have happened. The president did not actually, you know, withdraw the United States from NATO. You know, someone may, and I think probably Rutte did, explain to him that much of what the president has engaged in with Iran over the last month is actually, implied the use of NATO bases. I mean, we've got aircraft taking off from NATO bases. We have got aerial refuelers taking off from NATO bases. And that, you know, the ability of the United States to project power to other parts of the world actually starts in Europe. But the president also would face, to say the least, some legal obstacles. I mean, there's a actual law in the books that was part of the National Defense Act of 2023 or four, I can't remember now, which year it was included in the National Defense Authorization Act. But it was co-sponsored by the current Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, Marco Rubio.
That's why I'm smiling when you mentioned it.
Because he can't withdraw from NATO without
the Senate's approval, right?
The advice and consent of the Senate, two-thirds of the Senate. You know, arguably that law, I mean, if I were in the executive branch, I think I might think that law, you know, may not be quite constitutional. It might violate the Supreme Court's Chadha doctrine because it's a legislative veto. But, you know, at a minimum, we're going to be tied up in litigation for a while before that's resolved. There's also, in terms of punishing NATO member states, there's also a law in the books co-authored by the actual current Republican chairs of the House and Senate Armed Services Committee that sets a ceiling of 76,000 or a floor of 76,000 troops in Europe. And if the United States for more than 90 days goes below that floor, they have to seek a waiver. They've got to come in and explain to the Congress. The Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, would have to come in to explain to Congress why this was in the national interest and how this was done in consultation with NATO. So there's some real obstacles above and beyond just the, you know, self-harm that it would inflict on the United States. So is he just jawboning here? Is this just an, you know, performative, or is there anything real here?
Look, the whole thing is so bizarre. In any other field of life, if you had a CEO of a company or the principal of a school or whatever who was alienating everybody left and right, name calling, lying, cheating, and so on, you know, nobody would say, well, that's just his style. You know, you have to understand that's a negotiating position. No, I mean, they would be perceived as ill, you know, just out of bounds, not suited to the position, and so forth. And so this president, you know, has, and I don't know, it pains me personally as an American that this is the mess. This is the way we are being perceived by the world. A person who speaks for us, who kicks, NATO in the teeth constantly, lies about them, disparages their sacrifices in the wars after Afghanistan and Iraq, where they did fight along our side with us. It's the only time, as you've said many times, the only time that Article 5 has ever been invoked was on our behalf, not the other way around. And for him to just, he says, oh, they didn't do much. I mean, the whole thing is so humiliating to have him speak that way. And I don't know, you know, other than putting on burlap and ashes or something, I'm not sure. I mean, it's just horrifying. It's not to say the Europeans have been perfect. You know, they're people like all others. They have their own interests. But you, even as a prudential matter, we were in, and this, again, this is just grievous. We were in the most enviable position that a nation could be in, right? I mean, China had one reliable ally, you know, in North Korea, you know, and a few less reliable ones around the world. We had the greatest alliance of free, prosperous, and powerful nations on the globe. And we were the undisputed leader of that alliance, that coalition of the free and the prosperous. And to just blow it up, for what? It's mind-boggling, this kind of national suicide. Have I gotten too dark too fast? I'm sorry.
No, not at all. I mean, you know, so one of the things that struck me about this episode is the whatever one thinks about the regime in Iran, God knows I've written plenty about why it's important for this regime to, you know, go to the ash heap of history. But this was a war that he started without consulting our allies, without consulting, you know, the Congress or the American people. And he's angry because one of the consequences of the war, very predictable, was that the Iranians have closed the Strait of Hormuz, which everybody knew would happen if we got into a shoot up with Iran. And he wants the Europeans to essentially open the strait militarily, which is something right now the United States Navy is not willing to do.
Yes, we're not willing to do it.
So,
and I mean, we started the damn war.
Yeah. And now there's a further point here, which I think people don't appreciate, but you and I are old enough to remember some of these events. The United States, actually, at the outset of NATO, was the one, and if you read Article 5 and Article 6, it's very clear that the commitment that the defense of one is the defense of all is limited to North America and Europe. And that was very deliberate, and that was in part because France was already embroiled in late 1940s in a colonial war in Vietnam. Britain had far-flung colonial possessions. So did the Dutch. So did the Portuguese. And it was largely at U.S. insistence that those out-of-area theaters of potential military operations were seen as outside the bounds of the treaty commitment. In 1956, the French and British kind of tested that because they colluded with Israel and went in to stop Nasser from nationalizing the Suez Canal. Arguably, they were right about that. But President Eisenhower, in part because he was not consulted, said absolutely not. We're not. I mean, he had other reasons as well, some good, some not so good. But, you know, basically said no and almost broke Britain. You know, started selling pound sterling and forced the British and French to withdraw. And in this instance, the shoe was kind of on the other foot, isn't it?
Yes. You know, this president has such a limited imagination. He's so ignorant. I mean, I remember just the other day, the most recent funny example was he was talking about his next victim, namely Cuba. And he was saying, you know, and Cuba, it's a, it, you know, I imagine, you know, he's planning the Trump casino there or something. But he said, it's wonderful climate. They never get hurricanes. It's amazing. They never get hit by hurricanes. Typical Trump. But
there's a Sharpie somewhere waiting to be, to be used.
But, you know, it is, I've been critical of the Europeans in the past for not spending enough on defense. And I think, honestly, in fairness, you could say that Trump was not completely wrong in his insistence that the Europeans spend more on their own defense. His whole notion, which you've gone into in a recent piece, that, you know, they aren't like paying their dues. There are no dues. So he gets that part wrong. It's not a country club. But it is true that we bore the lion's share of the spending on defense, and that they were free riders for many years. And that did need to change. And that, you know, was something that you have to say Trump was sort of right about. On the other hand, look at what he is doing to those European allies. So first, he is threatening, he's threatening the alliance constantly. Not sure it's really in our interest. Then he actually threatens to invade a NATO member, Denmark, Denmark's territory in Greenland. And then he, because he has appalling judgment and thinks that the great American military is like a skeleton key that can unlock any problem, you just wave a magic wand. And he thinks that the reason previous presidents didn't apply massive force in Iran is because they were too timid. But of course, it wasn't that. It was that they sort of weighed the equities here and saw that, there's the Strait of Hormuz to consider. The regime is very entrenched, very hard to remove, do regime change from the air, et cetera, et cetera. They were prudent. And he is not. And so he goes ahead with this wild scheme. And by the way, Israel gets blame for this because Netanyahu, I think played upon Trump's vanity and urged. Trump has to take responsibility for it, but, Israel played a role here. Anyway, and so he does this, and the fact is the Europeans are much more dependent on Middle Eastern oil than we are. He puts a burden on them for his own vanity, right? I want to be the big man. I want to be the one who, solves this problem. I mean, that's not quite fair. There's probably like 10% of this is that he actually did think it's a bad idea to let Iran have nuclear weapons. That part is, of course, true. But he didn't have the wisdom to think through what's the best way to do it. There was no evidence. I mean, anyway, I'm sorry. I'm going on too long. But he wanted the Iranian people to rise up. He told himself lots of fables. And it's all, it's all appallingly bad strategy, bad planning, no planning, relying on a TV host who he made Secretary of Defense. Here we are.
Here we are.
They're losing the war. The U.S. is losing the war, clearly.
In the midst of all this, the Vice President of the United States thought it would be a particularly good use of his time to go and campaign for the Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban, who is facing a electoral defeat of pretty historic proportions based
we
on
hope.
The polling. In Hungary, based on the polling. I mean,
The
only poll that matters is when people actually come out to vote. But polling suggests he's in serious trouble. And yet, J.D. Vance went to Budapest and made what can only be described as campaign appearances.
Absolutely.
For Orban. I mean, I found this extraordinary. I mean, as a Foreign Service officer for 30 years, one of the things we were always taught was you don't involve yourself in the domestic politics of the host country. And it's hard to even imagine, how Well, actually, we can imagine it, because in 2024, J.D. Vance was one of the people who was screaming bloody murder that
Zelensky.
Zelensky came here and made an appearance with Josh Shapiro in mm-hmm. Pennsylvania. And that was arguably, you know, interfering in our election, when I don't think that was Zelensky's intent, actually. But
Zelensky also saw Trump and others on that trip. So
unlike Vance, who did not see Peter Magyar, the head of the opposition in Hungary.
Yes.
So can you unpack this MAGA infatuation with Orban? I mean, the fact that we're endorsing the candidate who also has been endorsed by Vladimir Putin and who was on the phone telling Putin, you know, I'm at your service, and who was offering to, you know, provide intelligence, you know, just mind-boggling.
And he's tried to block EU funding for Ukraine. I mean, he is absolutely Putin's man. So I would just go back a year or two to when Vance went to the Munich Security Conference, gave that speech where he basically chastised our European, didn't mention Russia, didn't mention the threat from Russia at all at a security conference. And he chastised them for trying to freeze out the Alternative for Germany party. And so that already, you know, gives you a flavor of where these people are. They regard themselves, obviously, as part of a post-liberal movement. It's kind of fascist. And they think it has it's an international movement. And it includes, and Orban is sort of the godfather because he was the first. It's worth noting that since Orban has been in power, he has become like a mafia don. He has put his flunkies in the judiciary and weakened it tremendously. He has had his allies buy up state media and alternative media so that people can't really have good sources of information. There's tremendous corruption. Freedom House, I think, puts it at the very bottom of all European nations in terms of freedom. They say it's not even really a free country anymore. And that's not anything that Orban would even contest. He says they're an illiberal democracy, and he's proud of it. And so what is this attraction? Why has he appeared something like 5 times at CPAC conferences? He's hosted CPAC conferences in Hungary. And certainly J.D. Vance and the president are heavily weighing in for this Putin pal. And I think what it shows is that this regime thinks the fight against liberalism and against liberal values at home is much more what they are interested in fighting than fighting against tyranny abroad. And he says that's what he thinks is that he's, I think I'm quoting Vance correctly, that he said that the biggest enemy is the enemy within.
So J.D. Vance, after swanning around with Orban in Hungary, apparently has a new diplomatic assignment, which is to go to Islamabad and negotiate at least indirectly with the Iranians, who may or may not be represented by Speaker of the Parliament, Kalibaf. This strikes me as, to purloin a phrase from the late original Supreme Leader Khomeini, a poison chalice, if you will. He is going to be in a very unenviable position, first of all, of negotiating on the basis of a ceasefire that people, wits better than mine, have classified as Schrodinger's ceasefire, because it both represents the Strait of Hormuz being open, but it's also closed at the same time. So he's got to, on the basis of that, negotiate an agreement when it doesn't appear there's much overlap between U.S. and Iranian positions. And so for him, I mean, failure obviously would be for his political future, not, you know, ideal. What do you make of this? And also the sort of blow up inside MAGA about all of this. I mean, it really tells you that we're living in the upside down when you find yourself, you know, sort of agreeing with Alex Jones and Marjorie Taylor Greene.
I know. When they were saying the guy's insane, he should be impeached. I know it's a really, truly crazy world. So a couple things. First, it's worth noting, and I think this tells you a lot, that even a week or 10 days ago, the Iranians themselves were the ones who were saying they didn't want to negotiate with Witkoff and Kushner. They only wanted to negotiate with J.D. Vance. And so now they are getting that request honored. So that tells you that, you know, somebody is in the driver's seat here. The other thing I would say is, I mean, you're absolutely right. He's in a very difficult position, especially considering that Trump can never be seen to have made a mistake or to have been wrong about anything. And if something goes wrong, there has to be someone to blame. And so I could imagine that J.D. Vance might be the person who's, you know, sort of catching those arrows at some point. We'll see. But in terms of, you know, I see these people online and, you know, saying this is a tremendous victory and they're drinking the Kool-Aid and believing that, you know, this will all turn out great for us. And I would say, look, there's a possibility, God knows, I hope it happens, that the Iranian people do rise up and eventually, you know, they overthrow this regime, maybe, you know, sooner rather than later, God willing. But right now, in terms of the outcome of this exchange of fire, where do we stand? Which side is saying we really can't do that again anytime soon, right? Because I mean, it's obviously Trump, because so many things have gone badly for him. He did not achieve, you know, the first few days he was saying, unconditional surrender. And then he was saying he wanted to choose the next Iranian leader. He was clearly thinking Venezuela. And then when things went south in that sense, he was flailing and confused. And he says so many contradictory things. You know, we've already destroyed the nuclear capacity, but we have to keep fighting until we destroy their nuclear capacity, and on and on. Even the truly surreal comment the other day that, well, yes, Iran is now going to be charging tolls for ships to go through the Strait of Hormuz, which before now had been open international shipping, right? I think there were 100, something like 100 tankers went through there daily. And lately there have been only 5, and only the ones who pay the Danegeld. And, you know, it's like, we are now like in a we were talking earlier about the U.S. international-led order. Well, one of the things that the U.S. international order provided for was freedom of navigation around the world. And so what do we have now? We have, you know, we have the Iranians in the newly empowered position of being able to charge a toll like those guys in castles on the Rhine in the olden, you know, pre-modern era. You want to pass, you got to pay. And so what does Trump say? He says, well, we may be able to work out a deal. We'll do it and we'll be a joint venture. Oh, my God.
Vance has done an interesting job. I mean, you were talking about the Iranians, you know, indicating their preference for him as an interlocutor. If you read the very deeply reported account in the New York Times by Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan of the decision making that led to the president to go to war, very interestingly, J.D. Vance is depicted as the one person who actually expressed some reservations about this, although he did
tell the president. Who's the leaker here?
Yeah, right. Who do you think? You know, Dean Acheson said no one came out, you know, second best in their own MemCon, you know, and no one, you know, comes out second best in the story that they leak, you know, to. So, so he's, you know, depicted himself as at least having major reservations, you know, about this. So does that put him in a position, if he can somehow pull off something that is a face-saving fig leaf of a compromise? I mean, it's hard to imagine how he does this, because as you just said, the Iranians right now are kind of have demonstrated that they can close the strait at will, and therefore they kind of have the whip hand on that issue. I mean, I think they've also suffered enormous damage and losses here, and they may not even understand how damaged they've been, because they've all been, you know, hiding in bunkers, lest, you know, a stray emanation from one of their cell phones leads to an airstrike by Israel.
Yeah, but, that's true.
But assuming he can come up with some kind of face-saving compromise here, does that put him in a position, does that give him kind of, you know, pole position against Rubio in 2028, because he's managed to hold together the MAGA right that has been disaffected by this, Megyn Kelly and Tucker Carlson and Marjorie Taylor Greene, with the regular MAGA crowd that's gone along with it? Or does it not make any difference, do you think?
Well, I do think that it is difficult for any vice president of a, if a president is perceived to have been exceedingly unsuccessful, it's going to be awfully tough for his VP to prevail. Now, maybe not in getting the nomination, but in winning the general. As far as the nomination goes, he, you know, it depends on who else is out there. It's not just Rubio versus Vance, although it looks like that right now. But I mean, what if Tucker Carlson presents himself, or, you know, something else? We know that the Republican electorate, the Republican primary voters, love people with zero experience in government. So, you know, who knows who else could be in the mix at that point? But it could be somebody who was even more, who wasn't just tepid on going to war, but was a vociferous opponent.
One thing, you know, you mentioned the role earlier of Prime Minister Netanyahu in selling this to President Trump in a meeting in the Situation Room on February 11th, when he came and essentially presented the president with a proposition, which was, this regime is very weak now. You know, a little application of military force will knock it over and lead to its collapse. And Trump obviously found that, you know, very persuasive. You know, I suspect he found it persuasive in part because his own risk tolerance had been increased by his relatively successful application of U.S. military force in the past, with the Soleimani strike and the Maduro abduction and the Midnight Hammer. All of those things, you know, had almost no repercussions and were relatively successful. So, you know, dizzy with success, to appropriate a phrase from Stalin, he went ahead and bought this. Am I wrong to think that this actually has been, not just this, but this and a number of other things that obviously have been done by Prime Minister Netanyahu have done enormous damage to Israel, and particularly to its standing in the United States, both on the left and on the right? I mean, I'm thinking of the Pew poll that just came out that shows declining support for Israel in both the Republican and the Democratic parties. I worry that in the Democratic Party, it's actually becoming almost, you know, completely unsalable to be pro-Israel anymore. And among young people in particular, and maybe this has to do with the fact that Bibi has been the face of Israel for, you know, more than a decade. So the entire period in which these people have come to political maturity, you know, Israel's standing is just, you know, abysmally low. I mean, as someone who I think shares my support for the state of Israel and the importance of the existence of Israel. I mean, I find this enormously troubling. Do you?
Completely. So many points to make. First of all, there is a tendency on the part of some to seize upon Israel's misdeeds, and there have been misdeeds, as an excuse for saying Israel has no right to exist, or, you know, whatever. And that is going way too far. And it's something that nobody imposes on any other nation when they misbehave. They don't say, you know, okay, so that didn't work out. Let's get rid of this nation. Right. But I do think that, the collapse of support for Israel on both sides, is partly to do with the fact that the Israel that is presented to young people now is completely different from the Israel that I knew growing up and that I visited. And by the way, Netanyahu once offered me a job about 35 years ago or something. But I, you know, in the past, before this Israeli government, when you would debate with people about the Middle East problem and about the Palestinians, you know, you could always say, and it was true, that Israel had been willing to give up territory, to make sacrifices for peace, to, they gave back all of Sinai. They unilaterally withdrew from Gaza. They did all of these things to achieve a peace deal. And each time it blew up in their faces. And what did they do in Gaza once Israel pulled out, as everybody said they should? So they abandoned Gaza and it became a terror territory to lob missiles into Israel and plot its destruction. So, one could make the case, and it was true in the past, that Israel had been willing to make all of these sacrifices in the name of a two-state solution, and that what they lacked was a partner for peace. This Israel in the Netanyahu government as it exists now, not previous Netanyahu governments that were Likud, this government is in alliance with the most radical right-wing, racist, and anti-Arab, you know, extremists that you can imagine, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. And they say and do horrible things. And so it is much more difficult to say, you know, in Israel, honestly, under Netanyahu, you know, they like Trump, Netanyahu has never seen a problem that he didn't think he could solve with a military solution, you know? And so, you know, he has been exceedingly aggressive. He has been terrible about explaining, you know, Israel. I think that a lot of the narrative about what happened in Gaza is overstated. I do not think there was a famine, you know, intentionally. I don't think there was, certainly there was hunger, but I don't think there was an intentional genocide. And a lot of young people just, that rolls off their lips. It was genocide. I don't think that's true. There was a lot of unnecessary suffering, but there's a difference. Anyway, the fact is, this Israeli government, far from saying, you know, Hamas is stealing the aid and Hamas has made it a policy of trying to hurt as many civilians as possible to gain international sympathy, which worked, Israel doesn't say that. It just simply fires away and says, this is what we have to do. And everybody hates us anyway, so we might as well just be strong. And it has been a public relations catastrophe. So collapse, support for Israel in the U.S. is collapsing. Jews worldwide are now in danger because of the anti-Semitism that goes with Israel's loss of stature. And that is inexcusable, by the way. I mean, the fact that people would target Jews anywhere in Vienna or New York City or wherever it is because of the actions of the Israeli government. But nevertheless, it is a reality. And it is becoming more frightening to be a Jew in this world than it was at any time in my lifetime.
Yeah, same. I, you know, I think, you know, there's a debate going on, as you know, and even among some of our colleagues in the Bulwark about, you know, what is tolerable, you know, in terms of people on the left. I guess what strikes me is that, you know, Rod Dreher, as you know, had a column in which he said, you know, he had.
Hadn't seen it.
No, this is an old one, a couple of weeks old. This is the one where he said about a third of the staffers on the Republican side on the Hill were Nazi adjacent. And he just said that he's been corrected by someone who said, no, it's more like 70%. And I worry that, you know, basically parties of the center left and center right, it seems to me, have an obligation to sort of police themselves. Something you and I have talked about in the past. I mean, Bill Buckley played an important role, whatever flaws he may have had, as recent biographers have suggested. He, you know, read the Birchers and the you know, extreme right wing anti-Semites out of the conservative movement. And you could make the argument, I think, that in the 1940s and 50s, the Truman, Humphrey, you know, Henry Jackson Democratic Party kind of did the same with the communist left.
And you know who people forget? George Meany, the head of the AFL-CIO. And, you know, he was a Democrat, very powerful Democrat, the head of the largest union. And he was an anti-communist in good standing.
Exactly. And so it seems to me that everybody, you know, everyone in these parties and movements needs to police themselves against the extremes. Mm-hmm. And if we fail to do that, I mean, you're getting what, if the Democrats fail to do it, let me put it that way, won't you just get what we're talking about now among the young Republicans on the right and just see it replicated on the left?
Yeah. You know, part of what I am finding so disheartening and difficult to deal with is that part of what makes me willing to use the word fascistic about the right these days is the willingness to engage in this vile, dehumanizing, cruel language, which we were trying to call out a long time ago, because when you start introducing that kind of rhetoric, it leads to that kind of behavior. And so you cannot say you're shocked that a party that talked about immigrants as vermin, you know, then starts, like, you know, grabbing people off the streets and, you know, putting them in shackles in these dungeons. I mean, that's what it leads to. And this is why I am very distressed when I see that there's a similar kind of thing going on the left, where they are very tolerant of this, you know, Hassan Piker, for example, for his language that is so dehumanizing, so cruel, so evil. And they say, well, yeah, but it's, you know, he's right, or we're on, you know, he's right about whatever. And it's like, well, wait a minute. Don't you see where that leads to? I mean, it's the same exact thing. And if you cannot have consistent standards that apply to both sides, then you don't really have principles at all. You're just a partisan.
I'm thinking of the, you know, the fact that when Liz Cheney still was in the leadership in the House, when I think it was Congressman Steve King in Iowa, mm-hmm. You know, was consorting with and expressing openly white supremacist views, she called that out, and mm-hmm. he then lost a primary, and of course she was then later expelled from the leadership. And what's happened is there's, you know, no governor at all on what can be said now by, you know, Republicans about Muslims or about or apparently among young Republicans about Jews. And so I just worry that, you know, we're going to end up in a similar place for the Democrats if they don't watch it, if they don't pay attention to this.
I mean, you know, when the Trump administration early on arrested Khalid, what was his name? The Columbia grad student who had, you know, been a leader of the protests. I wrote in his defense and I said, I don't like what he says, but it's free speech and he has rights and you can't just, you know, swoop him up in one of your little raids. I would love to see, you know, similar kinds of defenses of Jews. And I mean, you do see it. I'm not saying nobody does it, but it's just, it's so important for everybody to apply their standards everywhere.
You know, in the department of you can't make this stuff up because it's just, you know, so beyond the pale here. My successor several times removed as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy apparently called in the Papal Nuncio to express the administration's righteous anger against Pope Leo, the American Pope, who... you know, called for, you know, peace and understanding and I actually argued against precisely some of the kind of rhetoric you and I have just been talking about, threatened the nuncio with the prospect of another Avignon papacy, which, you know, really made me reach back into my undergraduate Western Civ, you know, lizard part of my brain.
Gosh.
This is so insane that we have this going on. We've got the Secretary of Defense having, you know, Protestant services for Good Friday, but no mass, no Catholic mass. And I wonder how this is all going to sit with our ultra montane vice president who has just written a book about, you know, his spiritual journey to Roman Catholicism.
It is remarkable that, you know, these people have the historical knowledge to go back to the Avignon Pope. So I guess, you know, a little backhanded compliment there that they at least know a little bit of history. But actually, it's kind of a chilling message, isn't it? That because it was the King of France who held the Pope captive, and it was an assertion of raw political power over spiritual power. Now, of course, at the time, the Pope was also a temporal power, not just spiritual. But that isn't a very good message. And also, no, it is, and this gets into the whole realm of our colleague Lauren Egan, who talks about, Will Sommer actually talks about the fights within MAGA, and. But this religious thing is something that has sort of caught me by surprise because, you know, they're sort of elevating Protestantism above Catholicism when you would think that they'd want to keep that whole Christian thing united. Something like a third of our U.S. military is Catholic, I believe. I'm not sure. But for Hegseth to march out this extremist minister, white supremacist minister who, you know, has all these, you know, extreme Protestant views and kind of speak that language is not just alienating to our allies around the world. It's alienating to a big chunk of the U.S. military. And what about the people who aren't Christian, who make up, you know, some portion of our military as well? There are Muslims, there are Jews, there are others, Buddhists, there are other people who have no religion who serve honorably. And this is, you know, they're hungry for a religious war. I don't know. I'm thinking about doing a podcast on a related topic because I just cannot get over these people who keep talking about Western civilization the way Vance did when just recently in Hungary, right? I mean, he led a chant with the crowd, you know, who will stand for Western civilization? And I find this a little curious because they have an awfully selective picture of what Western civilization is. Was, you know, Catholic supremacy for hundreds of years. It was also the Enlightenment, right? It was also the Reformation, and then it was also the Enlightenment. That, you know, the Enlightenment values are a huge part of what Western civilization stands for. They keep forgetting that part.
Yeah,
so I guess everything old is new again, I guess. We're going to refight the Hundred Years' War now, or, you know, great.
Yeah, exactly. We're running a bit short in time, so I want to just finish with one thing that you and I both share in common, that we served in the Reagan administration. I, as George Shultz's special assistant, you as a speechwriter for the president. And I have been so irritated by comments by Lindsey Graham that, you know, if the president succeeds in bringing down the Iranian regime, he'll be the greatest president ever, greater than Ronald Reagan. I mean, you know, this just seems to me to be total, utter nonsense. And, you know, for whatever flaws President Reagan had, he would never have engaged in the kind of rhetoric that President Trump has engaged in. He would never have threatened to destroy an entire civilization, you know. On the contrary, he actually had some appreciation for Russian civilization, as opposed to what the Soviets did to Russia, and was able to make that distinction, you know, and make it publicly. So I wonder, you know, do you share my frustration with this kind of, you know, silly, you know, sort of argument about Trump versus Reagan?
So I hate this argument when it comes from people like Lindsey Graham. I also hate it when it comes from people on the left who say there's no difference between Trump and Reagan. The fact is, and by the way, I should just say, I was not a Reagan speechwriter. I was Nancy Reagan's speechwriter. And then I did other writing for the president. I wasn't on the speechwriting team, in case any of them are listening. I don't want to misrepresent myself.
My bad.
But, No, it's fine. A few things. First of all, Reagan was, and again, he's a human being. He certainly had flaws. He certainly made mistakes. He had certain ideals that he genuinely believed in. And you can tell that he genuinely believed in them because, for example, whenever we were in a hostile posture with another country, he was always careful to make a distinction between the government that we didn't like and the people of the nation with whom we had no quarrel and indeed who we wished the best for. And he did that again and again with the Poles, with the Russians themselves, with lots of countries around the world where he, you know, Captive Nations Week, he would talk about, you know, the Estonians and the Lithuanians and Latvians. We had sympathy for the people who were being oppressed. And our quarrel was always just with a repressive government, not with an entire people. So that's in line with what you were saying about his respect for others and his basic humanity. I mean, you know, he, and then, you know, this, yes, the Reagan administration maybe wasn't tough enough on some of our Cold War allies because realpolitik, you know, required that they sort of accept certain less than desirable allies. That does happen, and it did happen. On the other hand, it's also important to remember that they basically pushed out an ally in Marcos in the Philippines. They worked very hard to make sure that in El Salvador, that was a key country at the time because we were trying to undermine the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, and it was a sort of staging grapher, that we tried to promote the centrist, center-right guy as opposed to the really bad right-wing death squad people or the communists. And those were our choices.
Rather than Robert d'Aubuisson.
That exactly. And so in that sense, the Reagan administration lived up to its ideals. And again, not perfectly, of course. But you know, it was a government that also respected the rule of law. It was a government that never took an action without calling in the opposition in Congress and briefing them and getting their input before any action was taken. It was a law-abiding, traditional American government. It was not a lawless freak show in service of a one person, a sort of a caudillo, which is what we have now.
I mean, I agree with all of that. And I would just add that he was also, you know, I think a quite good alliance leader. You know, Mrs. Thatcher in 1986 refused to, you know, let U.S. aircraft refuel on their way to Libya when they were doing airstrikes in Tripoli in as a result of the, I think it was the Liberty Bell disco bombing that Gaddafi's terrorists had orchestrated. And yet, despite that disagreement with Mrs. Thatcher, the two of them remained, you know, pretty fast friends and good allies, you know, despite the, you know, momentary, you know, disagreement and obviously plenty of displeasure, about it. And clearly we have lost that ability to lead alliances and to allow disagreements among allies to either be done privately or be buried, you know, once the event is behind us.
Because for Reagan, not everything was a test of his own ego, right? I mean, he wasn't a fragile, damaged human being. And so, you know, he was grown up and, you know, you're going to have disagreements with your allies and you get past it and you move on for the good of the country and the good of the alliance. These are all quaint, old-fashioned ideas, Eric.
I know. And I'm afraid they appeal to quaint, old-fashioned people like you and me, and there are not enough of us.
Hey, but, you know, I will say this, because, you know, when you get old, you get a huge amount of abuse online for being old. You know, it's just like, well, why aren't you dead yet, you know?
Yeah, right.
And I want to say to the people who, the haters out there, who say things like that to me, first of all, you should learn from people who are older than you. The whole point of life is to try not to make other people's mistakes, right? You get that opportunity. And in order to get that opportunity, you have to study what other people have done and listen to people who've had more experience. That's one thing. For another, I'm happy. Are you? I would say to some of these people, you know, and if you're not happy, maybe you want to think about that. Maybe I know a few things you'd like to know.
I think that's a perfect note on which to end, Mona. Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to have you, but it's been really a pleasure this afternoon.
Thank you, Eric. I appreciate it.